This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Emily Callahan was working at the Deepwater Horizon oil spill in 2010 when she noticed something strange. The workers would drop their fishing lines in the water right next to the rig. She thought they were crazy until they told her that's where the fish are. That experience started her down the path of helping companies turn old oil rigs into artificial reefs that support a surprising array of sea life. Emily Callahan and Amber Jackson co-founded Blue Latitudes in San Diego, California, and they join me now by Skype. Emily, Amber, welcome to Living Lab.
Thank you for having us.
Yep, we're happy to be here.
Emily, what kind of work were you doing in 2010 at the Deepwater Horizon oil spill?
Sure. Well, I was working as a field tech, and I was doing oil water sampling and biota collections. And at the time, BP had gone and hired all the fishermen who had lost their jobs because they weren't able to fish commercially in the area, and we were utilizing their boats. And the entire time we were down there, you know, the fishermen would just always talk about how great the fishing on the rigs were and how they just couldn't wait to get out on the weekends to go back fishing on the rigs. And of course, at the time, that seemed a little bit odd, considering the fact that we were out there collecting oiled water samples and biota samples. So it was definitely a really interesting experience.
You said these people could go out on the weekends. Why were they allowed to go back fishing then?
The Gulf, the entire area, you know, was obviously a lot of it was closed off for fishing that was specifically oiled, but there's thousands of platforms in the Gulf, so there's tons of fishing opportunities. And the Rigs to Reefs program in the Gulf is widely accepted, and the fishermen know those are some of the best fishing areas in the Gulf.
And why is it that Rigs to Reef is so popular in the Gulf area? I mean, I understand the federal law allowing artificial reefs goes back to 1985, and obviously you've said this is very popular. Why?
Yeah, so it's really interesting. Down there, they've reefed, you know, between 500 and 600 platforms. And the reason being is when you have thousands of platforms, there's a lot more familiarity with the program, lots more incomes and streams of revenue. So it's a much more widely accepted and understood program than when you compare to areas like California, where we only have 27. So when you have thousands of platforms, lots of people are connected to them.
And Amber, how did you and Emily get connected and start doing the work that you're doing now?
Emily and I met at Scripps Institution of Oceanography in San Diego, California. We were there for our master's thesis in marine biodiversity and conservation, which is a long way of saying a mixture of marine science and communication and economics. And we met in a AAUS scientific diving course. We were both there to get a certification to be able to go out and do research with other Scripps scientists. And it was through that experience that she started talking to me about her experiences in the Gulf of Mexico and about this Rigs to Reef program. And I have a background in ocean science and communication. And I thought of this idea. We were thinking, Rigs to Reef in California, how is this a possibility? And if so, what are those communication challenges that you sort of have to overcome when it comes to talking to a Californian who is definitely going to have a negative connotation towards the oil companies for the most part? And how do you talk to them about this idea of leaving an oil platform in place as an artificial reef? And how do you show them that maybe there's more below the surface?
I imagine one concern that you must hit upon fairly frequently is, are fish that would be caught there actually safe? Or have they been oiled simply by being in close proximity to a reef most of the time? Is toxicity a concern?
I think toxicity, you know, wherever you are, can be a concern in the ocean. But certainly, you know, they've done lots of work and lots of research looking at species that either grow on the rigs or swim around the rigs. And as long as there hasn't been a spill directly associated with that platform itself, the fish haven't really come up in any sort of toxicity screenings as having any sort of toxins in their body. In fact, in California, the majority of the mussels and scallops that are consumed there actually were harvested right off the rig. So most of the mussels on your dinner plate in California came from those oil platforms.
That would probably surprise a few people. Let's actually talk about what it takes to turn an oil rig into an artificial reef. I mean, I think that word reef, a lot of people automatically jump to coral reef. Is the structure being altered? Are species being introduced? What does it take to make it an artificial reef?
Well, that's a really good question. The second you put anything in the ocean, life is going to begin to attract to it. And there's going to be some sort of some sort of growth. So the reefs that you see mimic the natural environment. So in California, we see cold water reef species. That includes scallops, anemones, mussels. We see schools of Garibaldi and sheephead. A lot of native species that you would find in a kelp forest are growing on these platforms. Whereas in the Gulf of Mexico, where you have more tropical waters, you'll see a variety of your more traditional reef species. And so those platforms are developing reefs that are similar to the natural environment.
So then how much work does it take when you make that decision that this rig is no longer going to be an active rig, we'd like to turn it into an official artificial reef? How much hands-on work? What's the cost? What does it take to make it a reef?
So the second that the oil platform is put there, it begins to accumulate life. And when the oil company decides that they're no longer interested in drilling for oil, the platform or the well has reached the end of its economic life, at least when it comes to drilling for oil, they have to decommission the structure, which basically means remove it from the ocean floor. And during this process, they seal and cap the well, and they remove all of the extraction structures. And what that means is that the oil well is going to be closed forever. So it's not something that they can open back up or drill again. But the structure itself is a whole different story. Now they can leave that structure in place, the platform structure in place, or they can completely remove it. And leaving it in place is the rigs to reef option, where they'll remove the top side or the part that you see above the surface, and they'll recycle that on shore. And then they will leave the remaining below surface structure that has colonized all this life to continue to function as an artificial reef. And what they'll do is they'll donate that structure to the Department of Fish and Wildlife or whatever jurisdiction that the state has mandated will take over the artificial reef protocol. And what they'll do is they'll continue to manage that structure as they would any other artificial reef.
Can any rig be turned into an artificial reef or only certain ones?
Not all platforms are good candidates for the program. Platforms can range in depth from at the very shallowest, 85 feet, all the way down to 1,500 feet and even deeper. And all the structures are very different. Some are very old and some are brand new. And a lot of the new platforms they're coming out with are floating platforms. So really, every single platform needs to be assessed as to whether it would be a good candidate for the program, because not every platform is a good candidate for the program, even though all of them may be supporting artificial reefs.
And what about other kinds of structures that might be out in the water? I mean, we don't have a lot of oil rigs here off the coast of the Northeast, but we are seeing now development of offshore wind energy. Could those wind turbines be artificial reefs as well?
Sure. You know, the ocean is very funny. Anything that you put in the ocean, whether you're trying to grow an artificial reef or not, for the most part, a lot of it will attract life. Hard substrate, you know, rocks, wind turbines, oil platforms, toilets. That hard substrate really attracts life. Now, that doesn't mean they're all good candidates to be artificial reefs, but you'll find artificial reefs even growing off of piers. So any sort of harbor pier that you see will have mussels and barnacles and fish accumulating around them. And same with wind turbines. They'll start to collect life the second they go into the water.
What's the relative cost of, you know, these two options when you have a structure that you're looking at decommissioning, of either removing it or of turning it into a reef?
Through the Rigs to Reef program, the oil companies save a significant amount of money. And those costs, I'll give some ballpark numbers here. It really depends on the depth and the complexity of where the structure is located. But in general, let's just say that to decommission a structure the old-fashioned way, where the whole platform is completely removed, would cost around $5 million. But to put it through the artificial reef, Rigs to Reef option, it will only cost the oil company about $1 million to remove the top side and seal and cap the well.
I mean, for a fifth of the cost and presumably a benefit to the fishing industry, maybe an environmental benefit of this artificial reef, why do you think that this idea of Rigs to Reef has been slow to spread outside of the Gulf of Mexico?
You know, it really comes down to lack of public understanding and also just familiarity with these rigs. People always, as they as makes sense, harken back to large oil spill events like the 1969 Santa Barbara oil spill, or even more recently, the pipeline that burst up near Santa Barbara. And in the Gulf, you know, they have the experience of thinking of the BP oil spill and multiple other smaller spills that have occurred there. But the thing is, in the Gulf, they also have a lot of positive experiences associated with this program. They've seen 500 to 600 platforms reefed, and recreational diving is really big out there, as is recreational fishing. So the fishing community really supports this program down in the Gulf. It's brought back, significantly brought back, the red snapper populations down there. But in California, really, it's limited to a handful of recreational divers, underwater photographers, and a few recreational fishermen, but it's not the same sort of culture you get down in the Gulf of Mexico. So there's definitely not as much support in California.
You guys spend a fair bit of your effort on communicating these ideas to the public. Why does public support for this idea actually matter? Is there a public role in the regulatory process, or could an oil company simply decide that they want to turn their rig into a reef and move forward?
The public opinion absolutely matters, and it has a huge impact. When an oil company comes and says, we want to convert this platform into an artificial reef, it has a tendency to sound like greenwashing. In other words, you're saying that you have this huge and bountiful reef, but in reality, the oil company is just trying to save a lot of money, because they do save a lot of money. Versus when you have scientists going out there and educating the public and communicating the science effectively, it's really important, because for a legislative body to approve this law, to move forward with this law, they need to know that their constituents are in support of this law. They're not going to go ahead and make a decision that can be extremely controversial, and, you know, therefore jeopardizing their own position. And for an oil company to be the one touting the science, it's not always as credible as if you have a lot of public support and agreement with the concept.
Can a structure be an artificial reef while it's still performing its main function? I mean, you've already said life already starts to grow as soon as you put the structure there. Could an active rig or an active wind turbine also be an artificial reef?
Yeah, absolutely. For the most part, that's most likely what's going on, is that it's already functioning as a reef. Second, you put it in there, give it maybe a few years, and it will start to accumulate a good baseline of life and biodiversity, and then it will continue to support that unless we come in and alter it in some way. But these artificial reefs are, especially when the ones that are located offshore, such as wind turbines or oil platforms, are really important, because we are continuing to degrade our nearshore ecosystems with runoff pollution, overfishing. And what happens is a lot of those species nearshore are moving offshore and finding alternative habitats for life. And in California, we've seen this a significant amount with the population of rockfish that are going and spawning, breeding, growing to maturity on these platforms out there. And it's providing them a refuge as their nearshore habitat has been completely degraded.
You guys are conservation biologists, clearly concerned about the health of the ocean. Very few things out there are unmitigated evil, but by the same token, there are very few things that are 100% good. Are there drawbacks to the artificial reef idea, and perhaps to the idea of leaving a large number of structures in the ocean that we put there that weren't there before?
Yeah, you know, it's one of those dangerous lines to walk, because you certainly don't want to, because, you know, we've all grown up with the concept, don't throw things in the ocean. And that still holds true with artificial reefs. Not everything that can go into the ocean can be a good artificial reef. What's a little bit more unique about these structures is at least they were designed to go into the ocean. You know, you see a lot of times with ships to reefs, or people putting, you know, in New York, they put subway cars into the ocean. Those structures aren't necessarily designed to go into the ocean, and therefore you don't really want to encourage all sorts of materials just being dumped, assuming that it's going to grow an artificial reef. With the Rigs to Reefs program, again, you don't want to say every platform is going to be a good candidate, because, you know, I'm sure there is a tipping point at some point where you just have too many structures in the ocean. But the good news is we are losing a lot of our natural hard substrate, especially near shore areas where we continue to build ports. We continue to create seawalls. We're losing a lot of the natural hard substrate that we find. So in some areas, these platforms and other similar structures that have been researched and thought about and considered when placing them for artificial reefing purposes, they really are beneficial to the environment.
What are some of your new projects or upcoming projects that you guys are getting started on?
Well, we've been beginning to look at this idea of artificial reefing around the world. And taking a look outside of the United States, we found that over in Southeast Asia, they are repurposing their offshore oil and gas platforms as ecotourism resorts, which is fascinating because there their local economy depends a lot on local fisheries and on tourism. So by repurposing these structures as offshore hotels, they're drawing in a whole new line of dive tourism and it perhaps could be a model that could be replicated throughout Southeast Asia because there are thousands of platforms all around Malaysia and Thailand. And this could be something, you know, maybe the next destination for vacationing will be on an offshore rig.
Emily Callahan and Amber Jackson will be at the New England Aquarium on September 29th talking about the Rigs to Reef concept. Emily and Amber, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah.
Up next, a new holiday to ponder our place in the galaxy. It's called Galactic Tick Day. Hear all about it when Living Lab continues after a short break.